Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Dean Spade, Assistant Professor of Law at Seattle University, delivered a 2010 James A. Thomas lecture entitled Beyond Recognition. Professor Spade talks about the limitations of current popular legal equality demands emerging under the trans rights framework. Taking up some of the interventions of critical race theory and women of color feminism, as well as the concept of biopolitics, Professor Spade examines some of the pitfalls of law reform-centered social movement strategies and suggests alternative framework for imagining a critical trans politic.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here, and I really appreciate all the work that various faculty members and staff and students have put into making me feel welcome and helping me get here. And I'm so honored to be able to give a presentation that is in any way connected to the amazing work of Dean Thomas, especially reading about your contribution. I was particularly moved by all of your work related to changing how we think about law school admissions and understanding a more multidimensional framework for thinking about merit. As a UCLA student who was at UCLA after the after Prop 209 and the end of affirmative action, I was heavily politicized early in my law career to think about access to legal education as a cornerstone issue for equality in the United States. So I'm really just moved to get to be a part of anything related to someone who has made such a significant contribution to that work. So this is especially a special moment. So what I thought I would share is I'm working on a book project that is tentatively titled Beyond Recognition, something like Trans Politics and Law Reform. And I wanted to sort of give you all like the arc of how the book works and then talk to you a lot about one particular chapter and kind of go into more detail in one chapter. And this is related to a lot of the themes that were just shared that have been themes in my work for a while. So I thought first I would just kind of give you the general way that I summarize what the book is in a few paragraphs and then go into more detail about how it works. So the book, Beyond Recognition, I think I'm going to change the title, but Beyond Recognition hopes to be a politicized critical legal account of the emergence and consolidation of transgender identity in law and its reverberations in civil society. The project has two goals. First, it aims to chart the current trajectory of trans politics, one that I argue is rearticulating the limits of leftist, gay and lesbian, feminist, and anti-racist politics that have centered legal recognition and equality claims. Second, the book seeks to elaborate the possibilities of what I understand as a critical trans politics, that is, an understanding of trans politics that exceeds the quest for legal inclusion and instead raises a set of demands that challenge and transform current logics of state, civil society, security, and social equality. In developing this twofold account of contemporary trans politics, I hope to reveal the indispensability of trans organizing and analysis for both leftist thinking and social movements, as well as specific sites of intersection where trans activists and organizers can and are finding common cause with some of the most important political agendas of our time, prison abolition, wealth redistribution, organizing against immigration enforcement, and other forms of what some people call anti-oppression work. The book places the rise of discourse about trans identities and advocacy for trans recognition in the context of broader political and economic developments. These developments include diverse processes. This is sometimes called neoliberalism, right? This frame of neoliberalism. Some of them are mainstays of 20th century political economy, and others are more recent transformations of state and civil society. Things like the emergence of a neoliberal global economy, the war on terror, the rollback of 1960s and 70s welfare state and civil rights gains, the rise of what some scholars term the nonprofit industrial complex, the rapid growth of mass imprisonment, and the ascendancy of a gay and lesbian rights movement articulated through liberal notions of privacy and equal opportunity. In the context of these developments and the increasing disparity of wealth and life chances domestically and globally that have attended this period, Lisa Dugan talks about neoliberalism being the upper distribution of wealth. So sort of looking at the set of things that might be contributing to that, I want to ask, what do promises of anti-discrimination or equal opportunity actually deliver? What might trans law reformers learn from social movements that have won formal legal protections but whose constituencies remain criminalized and economically marginalized? How can such critical historical analysis help conceptualize the role of law in some kind of trans liberation struggle, if that's what we're doing? So the project first raises questions about the usefulness of the most commonly articulated legal interventions for trans rights, anti-discrimination laws and hate crimes laws, right? The most popular things people are talking about doing for trans rights. Second, it suggests that a different location within law, the administrative realm, may be the place to look for how law structures and reproduces vulnerability for trans populations. This analysis shifts the focus from the individual rights questions of employer, employee, or bash or bashed scenarios to think more broadly about how gender categories are enforced by the state on all people in ways that have particularly dangerous outcomes for trans people. Rather than framing trans marginality through concerns about only individual experiences of violence or discrimination, this framework examines how administrative norms or regularities create structured insecurity and maldistribute life chances across populations. While there are a number of critical paradigms for evaluating legal equality, this book emerges out of the space opened by critical race theory for its comprehension of the paradox of rights, that rights mediate emergent social groups and rights claims are often the resistant framework of such groups, while at the same time, rights become the means for new forms of control and new articulations of domination of such groups. Critical race theory identified the barriers that dominant legal models of intentional discrimination and violence that focus on punishing bad actors have created to identify and solve subordination. And critical race theory also drew attention to the distributive functions of law, providing solutions that avoid the focus on liberal individualizing conceptions of both oppressors and victims. Beyond Recognition takes up this approach and expands its analysis further into the domain of administrative law in order that we can see how modes of administrative governance produce what we come to think of as pre-political or pre-legal identities. Such an analysis allows us to reframe trans politics in terms of the distribution of life chances, and I'm getting, you know, that framework obviously from Foucault's theory of biopolitics for those who follow that. Such a framework leads to new and different questions about why trans people suffer economic marginalization and disproportionate imprisonment and what can be done about it. Beyond Recognition asks us to redirect attention away from recognition and inclusion-focused law reforms that are often assumed to be the natural law reform targets of trans liberation, perhaps because they have been the targets of gay and lesbian rights, rather than focus on law changes that declare equality or worth of trans life, but that prove to have little impact on the daily lives of people they purportedly protect. A distributive analysis suggests a focus on laws and policies that produce systemic norms and regularities that make trans lives an administrative impossibility. These laws and policies, which have greater impact on trans life chances, include the things like the rules surrounding gender classification on ID, the rules regarding the sex segregation of key institutions, shelters, group homes, jails, prisons, bathrooms, a lot of the locations where trans people face the worst violence because they're sex segregated, and rules governing access to gender-related healthcare, right? So like the Medicaid policies around the country that prohibit trans healthcare from being covered, things like that. This book reconceptualizes the role of law reform in trans resistance strategies, arguing against a focus on what the law says about trans people and for an understanding of how intervening in those law and policy venues that most impact trans people's survival might be a part of a broader trans politics, and the broader trans politics would have demands that are not limited to formal legal equality. Acknowledging the limits of formal legal equality-focused interventions and recognizing the conditions under which trans people come to seek various forms of recognition from legal structures, the book asks the larger question of whether legal recognition and inclusion are felicitous goals for trans politics. It suggests that not only might those goals undermine the disruptive potential of trans movements, but they also threaten to divide potential alliances amongst trans people as they have in lesbian and gay politics, and cause us to seek political change that ultimately disserves the cause of trans survival. As an alternative, the book proposes a politics based on the so-called impossible worldview of trans political existence. Such a politics builds from the space created by the insistence of state agencies, government actors, social service providers, lesbian and gay movements, and non-trans activists and non-profiteers that the existence of trans people itself is impossible and that our issues are not politically viable. The book suggests these challenges as potential starting points for a trans politics that openly opposes neoliberal and liberal agendas and find solidarity with other struggles articulated by the forgotten, the inconceivable, the spectacularized, and the unimaginable. Finding overlap and inspiration in the analysis and resistance articulated through women of color feminism, disability politics, prison abolition, and various struggles against criminalization and detention, immigration politics, and myriad movements for wealth redistribution, such a politics has far more to offer trans survival and can also contribute trans understandings to the analytical, strategic, and tactical developments of other emerging resistances. Such a politics grounded in creating democratic social movement structure is essential to this. So the book also looks deeply at how non-hierarchical models of social movement organization that focus on participation and leadership of those most marginalized is essential to the work itself. And part of that is an aim to account for and resist the current trend of nonprofitization that has tended to put white people, professionals, lawyers, et cetera, at the center of decision making, and given funders and philanthropy a huge amount of sway in the direction of social movement work. So the beginning of the book, the introduction, is primarily a description of sort of the kinds of issues that trans people are facing. And I start just by talking about my work at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project and the kinds of things people were showing up dealing with, right? So and sort of the interlocking issues, things that we could think of as explicitly exclusions, like having your family reject you because you're trans, or getting fired because you're trans, or getting evicted for being trans, or being kicked out of school for being trans, being, you know, targeted for violence, things like that. And also broader trends, like the marginalization of trans people into criminalized work because of unavailability of employment, and police targeting and police violence. And also this sort of other level at which we can understand gender as a technology of the administration of key government programs of all kinds. So what it means for trans people trying to access homeless shelters or DV services when those services are all gender segregated and that system doesn't see you the way you see yourself. So the ways in which sort of systemic classification strategies exclude people from basic healthcare, the ability to get ID, the ability to use their welfare benefits because the ID card says a different name and gender than the one that they go by, all those kinds of things. And so the introduction kind of tries to account for how that set of conditions produces sort of reduced life chances. There's a definition that I find really useful. The geographer and prison scholar Ruth Wilson Gilmore, she defines racism in a way that I think is sometimes helpful. She talks about, I'm not going to give you her whole definition because it's not all in my head, but she talks about group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. And so group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. So thinking about premature death, the production of premature death across certain populations as how we understand these forms of subjection, rather than thinking about, right, the typical legal model, which is like the intentions of the actor who excluded you, right? So the introduction is kind of trying to capture how that some of that's looking for trans people, the interlocking issues you're facing in, you know, social welfare systems, immigration systems, criminalization, foster care, juvenile justice, all these systems using gender as a technology of sorting, highly violent towards people who violate the rules of gender and the norms of gender, and that producing sort of all of these different life-shortening conditions. So part of my assertion is that anti-discrimination laws and hate crimes laws just like actually don't do anything about this. They don't seem to work for significantly shifting that. And that we, in order to, you know, sort of get at this, we need a different understanding of the political context of what's happening and of how power works. That's outside of the understandings that have been reflected and codified in law and in culture. Right? We need to understand and think about oppression or subjection or whatever that is, these systems of meaning and control that make certain populations vulnerable in a different way than we've been allowed to do when we think about sort of the legal recognition frameworks. So in the first chapter, which is called Trans Politics on the Neoliberal Landscape, I describe the set of trends organized loosely under the term neoliberalism that include policy changes such as privatization, trade liberalization, labor and environmental deregulation, the elimination and dismantling of health and welfare programs, increased criminalization and immigration enforcement, all these things contributing to this upper distribution of wealth I talked about, and decreased life chances for people on the bottom. Neoliberalism's hallmarks are co-optation and incorporation, meaning that the words and ideas of resistance movements are frequently recast to produce results that deserve the initial purposes for which they were devised and instead become legitimizing tools for oppressive political agendas. These trends have had significant impact on social movements in the United States. In the last three decades, we've seen a massive growth in imprisonment, a decline of our social safety nets, decreasing job security, a rollback on civil rights gains in the 1960s, the advent of the war on drugs and the war on terror, both of which shifted massive public resources and state capacities towards surveillance and criminalization of poor people and people of color. At the same time, the ability of social movements to respond to these changes has been hampered by the consolidation of corporate media, philanthropic control over movement agendas, and the nonprofitization and professionalism of activism, a strong need to focus on providing survival services to communities that have been abandoned by the state, and the targeted dismantling of the strongest movements with the most sort of transformative demands from the 1960s and 70s by the FBI and sort of the targeted COINTELPRO, et cetera. So in the context of these trends, activists and scholars have observed that many social movements seem to have become more conservative, have abandoned prior goals of radical redistribution, and taken up goals that fit more closely with the neoliberal agenda. You know, the typical, right, moving from Stonewall era, fighting against police brutality towards demanding hate crimes laws and increased prosecutorial discretion, right? The gay rights movement has received a great deal of critique on this front as it has been observed to drift towards a legal rights agenda, anti-discrimination, marriage and military inclusion rights, that provides little redress for growing numbers of people facing reduced life chances in the face of an increasing wealth divide. As trans activism has emerged more visibly and the trans populations have increasingly described experiences of economic marginalization and overrepresentation of criminal punishment systems, an important set of questions emerges. Should trans activism follow in the strategies that are deemed successful by a lot of people of the gay and lesbian rights legal reform agenda? For which trans people would such strategies win gains, and for whom might they worsen conditions? And this chapter sort of introduces this dilemma and provides a description of, you know, of how I'm going to try to think that through. The second chapter, I'm getting to the chapter I'm actually going to give you soon. The second chapter is called What's Wrong with Rights, and it basically uses some typical critical race theory moves that I'm sure many of you are familiar with to think about what's wrong with how the anti-discrimination principle doesn't get at what people experience as discrimination. So I rely heavily on a Freeman's idea of the perpetrator perspective that the law adopted, the notion that discrimination is something that happens when, like, I, one person, make a decision to exclude you, another person, right? And that, you know, you can't work here because you're a person of color, you can't live here because you're a trans person, whatever that is. And that what that model of understanding discrimination does, which is codified in law, is it focuses on intentionality. So I have to try to prove that I really said that, I really said, you know, which is very much impossible. It tends to hide and naturalize all the conditions in which things are maldistributed. So we can't talk in those conditions about how there's no adequate grocery stores in this community, there's no adequate schools, how we can't talk about any of the conditional stuff because we can't find a perpetrator who did it, right? Unless we can find that person who made that intentional violation, the law won't get at it. There's no remedy, right? It tends to dehistoricize, right? It erases all things that went on before. So no longer is it relevant that, you know, our racialized property system is founded in slavery and genocide. That's all that matters is whether you, the person who lives today, did this thing, right? So there's that kind of dehistorization that presumes a false neutral territory. And it scapegoats. It says problems like racism or homophobia or transphobia or sexism are the problems of certain bad individuals. And if we could just find those individuals and punish them, all would be well, which makes it impossible to see the ways in which we're all part of systems that produce that work again and again. And certainly, anti-discrimination law has been the target of a lot of this analysis. Hate crimes law, similarly, you know, could maybe even more sharply be said to adopt the perpetrator perspective. It's literally about finding the perpetrators who kill trans people. In this case. There's been an enormous critique, specifically from trans communities of color and low-income communities, about what it means to take on a project that further funds and supports criminal justice strategies for supposedly dealing with violence against trans people, when the largest perpetrator of violence against trans people is the criminal justice system itself, and that is where trans people face the worst, you know, conditions of violence, and what that means in the broader context of the massive growing prison system in the United States for sort of us to become part of in whose name that happens, right? So that sort of questions, those questions about co-optation that, of course, being asked broadly in neoliberalism. So anyway, now we get to the chapter I actually want to share with you, which is chapter three, which is where I'm trying to actually talk about how we might think about power differently. So this is what I want to focus on today. So if we come to understand the limits of a victim-perpetrator model, then what models of power and subjection should we use to think about trans people's experience of violence, poverty, and shortened lifespans? If passing laws that declare the hateful intentional acts of individual perpetrators punishable does not improve the lives of trans people, what would? A central argument of this book is that the standard law reform strategies through which the remedy for trans people's problems is most commonly sought fundamentally misunderstand the nature of power and control and the role of law in them and just won't work. To address the violence and marginalization that shortens trans lives, I suggest we have to reconceptualize how conditions are produced and examine what kinds of resistance will alter them. As part of that analysis, I'm particularly interested in understanding why declaring transphobic violence and exclusion illegal is an ineffective use of law reform, but other law strategies may actually be of some use to a broader trans struggle with demands that exceed law reform. To more fully understand the harms facing trans people and to strategize resistance to them, we need to break out of the narrow story that the current law reform framework tells us about how power works. Systems of meaning and control that maldistribute life chances, like racism, ableism, transphobia, and sexism, among others, operate in ways more complicated and diverse than the victim-perpetrator story tells us. If we want to understand why certain people fare poorly, do not have what they need to thrive and survive, and experience high levels of violence and shorter lives, we must analyze power operating beyond that individual discrimination model. Okay, I'm gonna skip some things. Okay, so the most familiar way of thinking about these questions of power within the liberal rights-focused framework that tends to dominate contemporary politics is to examine incidents of intentional, individualized negative action, discrimination, exclusion, and violence, right? So the scenes that come to mind are, you know, whites-only signs, trans people being fired when they come out to their employer, beatings and murders motivated by bias and hatred, right? Those are sort of the typical scenes we get in our minds of, like, this is what discrimination looks like, this is what oppression looks like. It's from these manifestations of power that we come to see the popularity of words like repression and oppression to describe the operations of various structures of disparity. This is the mode of power that is most easily recognized in liberal and rights-based frames as a violation requiring remediation, which is usually individualized punishment for the perpetrator. Another way of thinking about the operations occurring in this mode is the power operating through subtraction, right? It's opportunities, property, health, and life being taken away from individual victims by somebody's bad ideas, some perpetrator's bad ideas, right? So thinking of power in terms of repression or subtraction has been inscribed in law, in anti-discrimination laws and hate crimes laws, et cetera. This model has generated a number of concerns because it fails to account for the many problems that face groups who are on the losing end of systems of distribution and seem to remain there despite legal prohibitions on these kinds of negative, individualized, intentional action. As Alan Freeman argues, the perpetrator perspective prevents us from looking at the unequal conditions that entire communities live in because it allows only a focus on the bad acts of individual discriminators. To create a more multidimensional picture of how these systems work, we need to add some additional understandings of how power can operate. So the two additional modes of power and control that I want to discuss, I'm calling, and I'm again taking from Foucault with some changes, one I call a disciplinary mode of power, and the other I call population management mode of power, also called by Foucault biopolitics or governmentality. Naming and examining these two modes of power allows us to see what the perpetrator, victim, individual, intentional model of discrimination can't conceive about about the operation of systems like racism, sexism, ableism, and transphobia, and allows us to begin to understand broader set of relationships between law, control, distribution, and redistribution. Okay, so the disciplinary mode of power the way I'm using that refers to how racism, sexism, homophobia, ableism, et cetera, operate through norms that produce ideas about types of people and proper ways to be. These norms are enforced through internal and external policing and discipline. Institutional locations like medicine, the social sciences, education, places like that, where standards of proper behavior, healthfulness, and socialization are established and taught, are key technologies of disciplinary power. In such locations, we learn how to view our bodies, how our actions make us into certain types of people, and how to practice techniques to modify ourselves to become better. We learn how to be a proper man, woman, boy, girl, how to be healthy, chaste, punctual, productive, outgoing, or whatever qualities are valued in our particular context, and how to avoid being labeled as truant, criminal, mentally ill, promiscuous, lazy, sociopathic, addicted, slow, or whatever qualities are being considered not acceptable where we are. And we learn the archetypes of proper being and the techniques for reforming ourselves toward these ideals, and the impossibility of the ideal types generates a sort of lifetime of self-policing and external policing that keeps us occupied with these sort of internal reform efforts. These norms can differ, obviously, across institutions and subcultures, and they significantly change over time. The labels and categories generated through our disciplined behavior sort of keep us in place and help us know how to be ourselves properly. And obviously, the famous example that Foucault gave that a lot of people talk about is the invention of homosexuality, right? That in the 19th century, prior to the invention of homosexuality, sodomy was just sort of a criminal act. But after the invention of sort of sexology and this whole science of sexuality, there was an invention of like a type of person, and there was a childhood associated with it, and a morphology and a psychology, and that these have become these sort of inventions of types of people, whether that's the reproductive couple or the homosexual or whatever it is, the criminal, et cetera. These become sort of disciplining modes or ideals. You're trying not to be the bad ones, you're trying to be the good ones, et cetera. And obviously varying levels of violence enforce these things. Sometimes these are sort of soft disciplinary techniques where I learn, of course, I want to be punctual because I want to be a good student, or I want to, how to be polite or how to be social or any of those things, how to be clean, how to have an appearance that's proper, how to be attractive, all those things. And then also there's the heavily violent side of this, right? The forced institutionalization or medication of people labeled insane, forced assimilation of colonized people, right? Things like boarding schools for Native children, all of that kind of, the forcing of those disciplinary categories is also part of it. But there's the lighter ones, everybody should diet, everybody should exercise, all that kind of stuff. But all of them are the same kind of technology, right? And we all are constantly doing these to ourselves, as well as doing them to one another. Resistance to this kind of control has frequently focused on opposing norms that center whiteness, Christianity, heterosexuality, maleness, or gender binarism, and that articulate standards of health, intelligence, beauty, and reason that produce violent hierarchies of value. And usually, you know, what resistance does is try to propose alternative ways of being. So when activists form consciousness-raising groups that encourage people to question standards about how they see their own bodies and identities and replace those with those norms with other ideas that they consider better, they're engaging with this mode of power. When social movements critique media representations of their communities as lazy or criminal or mentally ill, they're engaging at this level. When controversies emerge over whether or not someone should be treated as something should be treated as a crime, an illness, or just one way of being, right? Like homosexuality, is it a crime, or is it an illness, or is it just sort of a way to be? Or obesity, or trans identity, or pregnancy, or drug use, all these things have been in that category. Those questions are about resistance to particular disciplinary norms and standards and a desire to recode the meanings of certain acts or identities. And so this disciplinary power, this one type of power, is one that the law has not conceptualized that adequately, right? So we can think about, you know, the Harris case in which the woman sues because she doesn't want to wear all this makeup and wear pantyhose in this highly feminized uniform to work, and the court says that's not a violation of your rights. That's not a problem for sex discrimination law. Or we can think of racialized dress codes, right? The, you know, rulings that said it's okay for this workplace to say that black women can't wear braided hair. All of those. There's many ways in which the law has not been able to capture this kind of thing as being a problem, right? And has said that those kinds of standards are neutral, accent discrimination, et cetera. Okay, so disciplinary power is one kind I want us to make sure we put on the table that the law maybe is not fully accounting for. The second kind is this population management or the distribution of life chances. In addition to discipline, the other mode of control that is missing in the legal narrative of individual intentional discrimination is what I want to call population management. As I suggested earlier, this is perhaps the mode that is least comprehended and addressed through liberal claims to rights and formal legal equality. This mode includes interventions that impact the population as a whole, usually interventions undertaken through the logic of promoting the health or security of the nation. Broad-based programs, in fact, the very programs that constitute the nation itself, such as taxation, military conscription, social welfare, programs like Social Security, Medicaid, public assistance, immigration policy and enforcement, criminal punishment systems, the census, and identity documentation programs, passports, driver's licenses, birth registration, are technologies of this mode of power. These programs operate through purportedly neutral criteria that aim to distribute health and security and ensure order. They're caretaking programs. That's one way to think about them, right? They're programs that are about caretaking the population. So whether that caretaking is by excluding Chinese immigrants at one point in history, or whether it's by excluding people with HIV from immigrating, or whether it's by providing old age insurance, they're all caretaking mentality that operate at the population level. They operate in the name of promoting the life of the population, and in doing so, they frequently, and Foucault would argue, always produce clear ideas about characteristics of that protected population that stand in opposition to others who are characterized as drains or threats to the population. In the US, these distinctions always operate through racialized and gendered frameworks. The disciplinary mode of power establishes individualized norms for a proper productive citizen, worker, adult, man, woman, student, et cetera, while the population management mode of power, through this mode of power, those standards and meanings are mobilized to create policies and programs that apply generally. These general policies and programs use classifications and categories to reach their targets rather than operating on the individual level. In the post-civil rights era, where law has purportedly become colorblind and otherwise equal, explicit race and gender classifications are rarely written directly into the design of these programs. However, ideas of race and gender are mobilized to support a general policy or program that does not target a group so explicitly on its face, but that still accomplishes its racist, sexist purpose. A memorable example is how the depiction of welfare queens portrayed as black single mothers cheating the welfare system in the 1990s was used to support the elimination of certain public assistance programs. Another example is how the demonization of Latin American immigrants, depicted both as system drains and overly hardworking job stealers, is used to justify heightened immigration enforcement. A third example is how the production of images of black criminality is used to justify a range of war on drugs policies, from sentencing enhancements to exclusion from public housing and higher education for people with drug convictions. The origins of these population-level programs and their evolutions are impacted by shifting mobilizations of racialized and gendered images that construct ideas of us and them to create policies that impact people at the group level. The campaigns to wage welfare reform, the war on drugs, the war on terror, called for a protection of the national population from cheats, drains, and threats, producing a racialized gendered idea of the nation that is borne out in racialized gendered impacts of these programs. So the flip is also true, right? It's not just the programs I don't like that I think are targeting people. It's also the programs like Social Security, taxation, all of these programs operate through the same type of population management power. And all of them, I would say, have racialized and gender vectors establishing the US population and the population that is somehow a drain, threat, or concern. These policies and programs distribute wealth and life chances in a way that does not focus on the individual, but rather intervenes in swaths of populations through particular characteristics. As a result, policies and programs that are race neutral on their face will have highly racialized impacts, like ending public assistance programs or enhancing immigration enforcement. And also, policy and programs passed through an appeal to racialized or gendered targeting will also impact people not imagined during those during the mobilization of those images, right? So some white people will also lose welfare benefits or be deported, but mostly it'll be people of color. Right? It's not an exact fit in the way that anti-discrimination law usually requires, right? We can see how these methods of power and control are impossible to conceive of under the individualized intentional model of oppression, because such scenarios do not involve an individual person being excluded because of race or gender, and in fact can include some people belonging to a privileged group in their impact. Therefore, they do not demonstrate the kind of nexus between intention and impact that is imagined in the realm of individual intentional discrimination models, yet they create enormous population level racialized and gender disparities in life chances. So thinking about like San Antonio versus Rodriguez or Milliken or other cases. Their impact, in fact, may be much more significant than the impact of day-to-day individual discrimination. And one I go into that I won't go into now is that, you know, the racial wealth divide in the United States is a clear example, right? So we've had this racial wealth divide throughout the entirety of the United States, and it can't just be explained by figuring out if they're like racist employers or bankers excluding people of color from economic opportunity. Like that wouldn't, if we found all those people, we wouldn't solve it, right? Because it's produced, you know, initially through racialized slavery and land theft at the beginning, and then it continues with redlining, Social Security Administration exclusions, the GI Bill implementation problems, the trend away from taxing wealth and towards taxing income from work, Jim Crow laws, Asian exclusion laws, tiered welfare programs that make subsidies to predominantly white populations safe, politically safe, while subsidies that predominantly support families of color are always meager and targeted for elimination. You know, we can think about all the ways in which there's a state role in shoring up property relations. I was just in New Orleans, as I'm sure many of you were, for the ALS conference, and thinking about how the people who lost their, you know, the decisions, the kind of government abandonment, right, of that space that produces this natural, totally unnatural disaster, right, that's completely constructed by government abandonment, and then the set of black homeowners who lose their property value forever, right, and sort of that property is something that always needs to be kept up, also not only by the individuals but also by the government, that sort of structures and constructs our ability to claim our property or for it to have value. Anyway, I'm going to skip a little bit of this. Okay, so to limit our inquiry about why the racial wealth divide exists in the U.S. to a search for individual racist employers or bankers would suggest that besides these few bad apples, the economy is racially fair and neutral. Such a framing is often accompanied by an assertion that people of color are to blame for the disproportionate poverty. Such an analysis hides the true conditions and operations of power that produce a correlation between wealth, race, and lifespan. It is only when we look at population-level modes of control and distribution that we can understand and account for the racial wealth divide rather than justifying it through racism. And the myth of legal equality in the U.S. is supported by a story about how U.S. laws used to exclude people on the basis of race and gender, and now they don't. And now all is fair and equal. However, population-level programs that were mobilized at their inception by explicit race and gender exclusions tend to continue to do that work of distributing safety and vulnerability along race and gender lines just under the auspices of race and gender-neutral criteria. And I'm going to skip the part about where I tell you how the history of welfare matches that, because I'm taking too long. Okay. You know, so one clear example I will mention is that the rapid use of growth of the U.S. Criminal punishment system is a place where we can see how population-level interventions are mobilized by racialized and gendered narratives. The quadrupling of the U.S. prison system in just a few decades was accomplished in large part by the passage of laws that increased sentences for certain charges related to drug use, possession, and sale. Popular support for these charges was built by panic-inducing discourses from politicians and media about gang warfare and crack cocaine. Exposé-style media stories, an explosion of police and prosecution television shows and movies, which we still have, and the declaration of the war on drugs all participated in the portrayal of a threatening proliferation of violence based in black communities. The policies and practices that resulted in placed more police in poor communities and gave them more tools for surveilling, arresting, and detaining community members, and also increased barriers to survival for people convicted of drug possession or sale by eliminating their eligibility for public housing and student loans, among other things. While the official narrative of the criminal punishment system is about individual accountability for wrongful acts, the implementation of population-level interventions mobilized through racialized and gendered frameworks of threat and drain resulted in a system that does not target users and sellers of illegal substances, but instead targets people of color for imprisonment. Right? That's under the name of users and sellers of illegal substances. The distinction between the disciplinary mode of power and the population level control I'm talking about is important here. At the level of norms and discipline, we each learn the rules of how to be and how not to be, and you know, sort of how to be right in various ways, and we struggle and strive to meet those standards, even sometimes by inventing our own new subcultural norms. And we also participate in encouraging and coercing others, our children, our coworkers, our elected officials, to follow them, right? That's something we're all doing at the individual level. The meeting and not meeting of these norms in that mode occurs at the individual level. We might be shamed for dressing unprofessionally or being too large or too small or too loud or too quiet or too compassionate or too violent or too feminine or too masculine. At the population level, however, the operation shifts and the individual behavior is not the target of intervention, nor can we prevent it, nor can it prevent vulnerability. Population level intervention creates conditions of control and distribution that impact people regardless of their individual acts. Living in communities impacted by policy decisions that have made schools, healthcare, housing, and infrastructure insufficient, that have been zoned for toxic industries, and where high levels of police presence increase the likelihood of being arrested for behavior that may be just as common elsewhere, but without the same enforcement, are examples of conditions that impact the health and security of populations regardless of their individual acts of complying or failing to comply with various norms. On the reverse side, people living in a community with high quality services, clean air and water, protected from criminal enforcement, these people may retain enormous health and security regardless of violating various social norms, right? Teenagers caught with drugs in these two communities will not experience the same consequences. Adults who neglect their children in these two communities will not experience the same consequences. People with psychiatric disabilities in these two communities will have very different experiences. Although narratives about what constitutes a proper citizen, neighbor, woman, man, student, worker impact disciplinary codes that we enforce on ourselves and each other, they're mobilized in the promotion of certain population level interventions, they operate differently in the individual context versus the population level context. Being able to understand the overlapping but distinct operation of these two vectors is essential to an accurate analysis of how transphobia, racism, ableism, sexism, and homophobia work, and also to conceptualizing methods of resistance to them. Okay, I'm skipping a little. Okay, so understanding the other two modes discussed here is essential to discerning the causes of the kind of structured insecurity and shortened lifespans faced by trans people that I described in the introduction. The level of analysis that focuses on disciplinary gender norms, however, has received far more attention in trans scholarship and activism than the discussion of population-level interventions. Trans activists and scholars have explored how the medicalization of trans identities forced trans people to conform to rigid gender norms in order to access medical technologies if we want or need them, how gender norms motivate employers to pass over trans applicants for hire or fire trans employees, how gender norms in families and religious groups result in abuse and rejection of trans young people, how gender norms are even used among trans people to establish norms of transness that we enforce against one another or internally against ourselves. Analyzing how trans and gender nonconforming vulnerability is produced through population level interventions, however, has not really been explored that much. Examining this conception of power can help us do a few things. One, analyze the use of gender as an administrative category by state and civil society institutions of all kinds, schools, hospitals, DMVs, employers, tax systems, prisons, welfare systems, et cetera. Two, formulate understandings of the racialized nature of key population level interventions like prison expansion, the war on terror, the expansion of immigration detention, the elimination of welfare entitlements from the perspective of trans and gender nonconforming experience. And three, formulate strategies for resistance and transformation that actually reach the set of harmful policies and practices that shorten lifespans for trans people through mobilizing race and gender norms at the population level. Such an analysis and action requires a break from the legal rights focus that has come to seem like the natural target of marginalized groups and that has been modeled by the gay and lesbian rights formation in recent decades. In fact, legal inclusion and recognition demands at times reinforce the logics of harmful systems by justifying them, contributing to an illusion of fairness and equality, or reinforcing the targeting of certain drains or internal enemies by remedying the exclusion of others. And just briefly, I'll say that you know, the example I've given here is the relationship of lesbian gay law reform projects to the field of criminal law. The two big things that it's demanded are the decriminalization of sodomy and hate crimes laws. And you know, if you really, so the choice has been about these targets that kind of are like, what does the criminal law say about us? Let's change what it says about us. And what I argue is that if the aim were really to reduce the number of gay and lesbian people in prisons and jails and to reduce the violence, medical neglect, nutritional deprivation, and other conditions faced by gay and lesbian prisoners, the legal strategy would have been very different. right? Joining and creating lawsuits focused on prison conditions, opposing sentencing enhancements for drugs and other nonviolent behaviors that are responsible for the bulk of imprisonment, and for all people, including gay and lesbian people, and generally opposing prison expansion and increasing criminalization would have been the ideal targets, right? Instead, the goal of these interventions was to change the parts of the criminal law that explicitly named gay and lesbian people as criminal, right? To stop from going being named badly and be named in a good way by the criminal law. And such a concern sort of is caught up in the explicit intentional operations of homophobia that are written into the law but leaves out an understanding of the distributionary effects of criminal punishment that would actually relate to decarcerating gay and lesbian people or improving the life chances of gay and lesbian prisoners. These strategies have the danger of not only failing to actually improve the life chances of people in whose name they operate, but also strengthening the criminal punishment system by allowing it to appear fair and neutral and even adding to its capacity to criminalize, right, which is what hate crimes laws do. Does the end of sodomy and criminalization and the addition of sexual orientation to penalty-enhancing hate crimes laws mean that criminal punishment is no longer homophobic, right? This kind of work has a danger of suggesting so. The other danger of such a strategy is that it's produced by and enhances race and class divides amongst gay and lesbians that correlate to experience and views of the criminal punishment system. For those living in white communities not targeted for policing and imprisonment, the criminal punishment system may appear to be a protector, and its perceived flaws may be limited to these narrow, explicit exclusions and exclusions. For those lesbian and gay people raised to fear the police, and for those who have experienced the ongoing violence, loss of family members, targeting by the juvenile and adult punishment systems, the more explicitly homophobic exclusions and inclusions may be a small and possibly insignificant demand, because they may crave interventions that do more to reduce and end imprisonment and or protect prisoners. Even more importantly, people who are part of campaigns to dismantle systems based on an understanding of those systems as articulating control at the population level may understand reforms that are solely concerned with how those systems describe themselves as misguided. The hate crimes legislation demand has the danger of building the criminal punishment system by enhancing penalties and resources for groups organizing to oppose punishment and detention systems, including people of color, people with disabilities, and poor people. Such reforms run in opposition to their work. So we saw this when the federal hate crimes law passed, and a lot of queer people of color groups put out statements about, you know, the limitations of that strategy. Similar controversies have emerged in other instances where usually white-led, lesbian and gay, and sometimes trans reform organizations have sought inclusion or recognition from systems that feminist, racial justice, and disability activists and scholars have identified as key nodes of maldistribution of life chances. The quest for inclusion in the U.S. military service, as well as inclusion in the institution of marriage, have generated these same rifts, which I'm sure people are familiar with. The history of these controversies and the political choices made during their development relates to the rise of neoliberalism in the wake of social movements in the 1960s and 70s. The early gay politics of the Stonewall era was influenced by and included overlap with the demands of racial justice, feminist, anti-colonial, anti-war movements of the time period. Critiques of policing, imperialism, social norms, and structures, systemic patriarchy, including marriage, were co-articulated and interwoven by many groups and individuals of that time. As backlash to those movements rose and law and order politics combined with the rise of nonprofitization of social justice emerged, a newly mainstreamable gay and lesbian politics focused on inclusion and recognition emerged. With formal legal equality in the form of marriage inclusion, sodomy decriminalization and anti-discrimination, military inclusion, and hate crimes as its primary targets. The analytical frameworks of the 1960s and 70s social movements, with their focus on broad population-level disparities, was replaced by an individual discrimination-based understanding of racism, homophobia, ableism, and sexism, both in law and in popular culture. The results were legal reforms that mostly maintained those systems of maldistribution and control and even enhanced them in the name of equality, individuality, and even diversity. As trans politics develops, a similar set of choices are before us. Inclusion and recognition arguments that coalesce around hate crimes laws and anti-discrimination laws are the obvious targets of trans law reform because they've been modeled by gay and lesbian legal rights strategies, and because there's a broadly believed myth in the U.S. that such strategies ended racial subordination, which none of us believe, I hope, but is commonly discussed. However, the limitations of these strategies have been well articulated by women of color feminism, critical disability scholars and activists, and critical race theory, as well as radical queer and trans people. Understanding the understandings of control, distribution, and power that these critical perspectives provide expose the limitations of the law reform's targets and generate a theory of change that might include a different set of law reform issues, while at the same time decentering legal reform as a strategy and demand for transformation. So I'll just finish by saying that the book goes on to look specifically at why we might look at the administrative law realm and what we might look at there for trans people, and then more broadly looking at how we could move legal reform demands out of the center of social movements, in particular trans social movements, and a lot of that is by looking at specifically the rise of nonprofitization and the ways in which leadership development in social movements has made social movements in the U.S. less and less democratic in the last 30 years, and what are the models for democratizing social movements so that lawyers and other professionals aren't at the center building agendas based on our biographies, right? And so that, and the paper, the book goes on to sort of look at some of the models of how that's being done, especially by queer and trans people of color organizations in the U.S. and the kinds of projects those organizations are taking up and the very different relationship they have to law reform and to legal strategy generally than sort of your typical like legal organizations run by lawyers with an agenda set by lawyers. So that's the broader arc, but I'll just leave you with that for now.